Word Radio, the podcast where we ask, what the f*** does young cancer survivorship mean? With me, Helen King, and guests. Subscribe and rate on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Welcome back to the C Word Radio. This episode is going to be slightly different from my previous ones. June is my cancerversary. I was officially diagnosed with HER2-positive breast cancer on June 14th of 2018. And there's so much I feel like I could cover in an episode about my experience of diagnosis, treatment, and the past 4 years. But I've chosen to focus on something that, in a way, has been an outcome of my cancer. I'm not sure if outcome's the right word, but the stress of the cancer diagnosis and the treatment and being put in a chemical menopause certainly helped me figure out that there was something not quite right. I've shared before about having ADHD and that I was diagnosed as an adult. Stress and the drop in estrogen during menopause made my ADHD so much worse, but I didn't realize that's what was going on at the time. I just thought that I was a mess and couldn't cope with things. Over the next two episodes in June, I'm going to be talking to people who have been through a cancer diagnosis and are neurodivergent like I am. Looking back, I can see how having undiagnosed ADHD impacted my treatment experience. I was trying to manage appointments, taking medications, and taking in a whole lot of information and being expected to remember it. And now that I look back at it, I have no idea how I managed any of it. And sometimes, in all honesty, I didn't manage it at all. I'll be talking to my beautiful friend Alyssa, who, like me, was diagnosed with ADHD as an adult. She is my soul sister, and we were introduced by a mutual friend, Tini, who is also a ADHDer. And oh, I love them both. Alyssa had thyroid cancer about 15 years ago, and we have had quite similar experiences of managing cancer and an undiagnosed condition like ADHD. Today's episode, you'll be meeting one of my online friends, Denise Carter Bennett, who was diagnosed with ovarian cancer when she was 11. Denise is autistic and has ADHD, and she has faced so many medical issues in the past few decades. Her cancer diagnosis at such a young age had a really big impact on her, and now in her 30s, she's still grappling with side effects. A quick warning, we do mention sexual abuse and infertility, and you know me, there will also be the odd swear word. This is Denise's story.
Being autistic and ADHD and going through cancer like I did as a kid, and the fact that it also happened to me right when I started puberty, you know, I only had my period for maybe a year.
Wow, yeah.
So it was a huge thing for me where my body was going through all of these changes and then all of a sudden having this cancer and then going through the surgery that I did. And earlier that year, before I was diagnosed with the cancer, obviously I was hit by a car and I broke my ankle and had one of my front teeth knocked out and stuff like that. And so I was actually in hospital for nearly a month because of bones that I broke and everything else that had happened. And I just, I needed the medical help. And because of it, I ended up pretty much having a whole term off school. The last term of school, I went back. I thought everything was okay. I had to be really careful with my ankle because it only just managed to heal itself. And then I remember around October that year, I had felt a bit off, but it was just like I started feeling more and more pain in the right side, my abdomen. And at first I went to the doctors and they thought it was just kidney issues because I had some kidney problems when I was a baby. And they thought, okay, maybe it's just like your kidneys, and they put me on some medication and that didn't help pain. I just got more and more sore and that bloated feeling and things like that. It just got worse and worse. And then in November, the pain was increasing. I was like, oh, this is not good. And, I then had to stay back at home again because I couldn't actually get out of bed because of the pain and I was throwing up all the time and all this other stuff. I just couldn't keep any food down. And so the GP actually did a hot visit and she thought, okay, maybe this is actually my appendix because it seemed like I had appendicitis. Mm. But she was like, maybe you have pleural fever, or it seemed like that's what it was. And so I went to the hospital and it was, Yeah, just I think some of the symptoms sometimes do talk about was like they, you know, obviously want to know how this pain developed and stuff like that, and then they have to ask you questions like, you know, I remember it so clearly that I was in the emergency department. I was in a room by myself with my dad, and three doctors walked in and with my dad in the room, and they whispered to me, they're like, you can tell us if your dad has, you know, touched you in any way that's not acceptable. And I was like, oh, I just said no. And they were like, okay, because we can see something has happened to you as a child. And I just remember just like inside, because obviously like, something I do talk about very openly is that I am a survivor of sexual assault and the R word, which I went through as a kid. And so it was really hard going through that. I was in the hospital for like nearly a week, and it was like this pain was getting worse and worse. Hadn't pooped for a while, and everything was just building up. And then they finally managed to get me in. Yeah, it was the day before I turned 12. I remember it distinctly. They finally managed to get me in for an ultrasound at like 4 p.m. and they wheeled me down. At 4:30, they did the ultrasound, and then the person who was doing it, she saw the tumour that I had in my right ovary. It was a 6x8 centimetre tumour that I had.
Whoa.
She could see that the mass was like starting to grow along my fallopian tube as well. And she's like, you don't definitely have appendicitis. This had been actually the first time that the hospital, because it was Starship Hospital, they had actually seen someone this young with this sort of tumour. And they had absolutely no idea what to do. And so they actually had to call over doctors from, you know, the adult hospital to come over and to have a look. And I remember just like lying there until the specialist like ran over. At that time, for some reason, there was a visiting specialist from the States, and he had come along as well because he actually had specialist knowledge in treating children with ovarian cancer. They didn't say the C word at the time. They just said, I just had a tumour. I could see it as well, so I could see it on the screen. So it was at 4:30. About that, an hour later, they all come along, and I quickly call up my dad, and he had to agree over the phone that I could have surgery as soon as possible. And so they did all that, and I remember I went as well back to the room, and I was allowed to sleep. The doctors came back in that afternoon, and they told me that pathologists had been working really hard to look at the cells and grade what it was, because they said usually even with that it would take them a couple of days, but they were quite anxious with it and just being told the C word, and that they thought because I was of my age that I wouldn't understand what they were saying, and they were really trying to, again, like use dumbed down language. And the nurse had been looking after me that week. She just said, and said, like, no, just use the full terms. She's very intelligent. and they told me in the procedure I had. And I, again, I remember the term, you know, a unilateral salpingo-oophorectomy. And I was like, oh, okay. And they showed me it in a jar as well. I actually lost a jar. I actually asked. But after they'd been taking like slices out for testing, they gave me a jar. Yeah. It was like, you know, I think it was formaldehyde because I wanted it. Like, I was just fascinated with what they just like cut out of my body. They probably thought I was like a really weird kid, but you know, there was my brain trying to process the fact you've just told me that I've got cancer. And yeah. Like, okay, can I have my ovary and fallopian tube now? You told me you were going to give it to me in a jar, and they did. But yeah, that the fact that just hearing those words, and then they said, "Oh, it's going to take us a little bit longer to know what stage and grade it's at and stuff like that." So a couple of days later, they finally told me what stage it was at, and it's a state. It's a newer system now, but under the new grading system, it's considered a, you know, stage 1C2 cancer, where the cancer was not just enclosed in the tumour, but cancer was on the surface of the ovary and along the fallopian tube. And then I was stuck in hospital for like another 2 weeks after that to recover from the surgery. Yeah, so there I was at the age of 12, walking around with what looked like a C-section scar, because my stomach was really bloated and swollen from the surgery as well, because they had to wash out my abdominal cavity with all sorts of stuff, just to be on the safe side of, making sure that they had managed to get all of it. But yeah, that was really hard. And then I had to obviously have 6 weeks worth of chemo after I'd recovered enough from the surgery. They didn't want to leave it too long because of the type of cancer that I have. It's a germ cell cancer. Germ cell cancers are probably the most notorious for like just going full nuclear in a space of like, they don't stay stable for very long. Usually most of the time, with germ cell tumours, especially when it's ovarian, a lot of the time it is benign and you're fine and they can just remove it and that's it. But once the cells do turn malignant, that's when you're dealing with a ticking time bomb that's just going to go off at any time. Yeah. So because of it, I had to go through the chemo and that was just as like extra assurance that even though through the surgery they could see that they had then managed to remove all the cancerous tissue. So that was really hard, because going through 4 weeks of recovery and then having the chemo for 6 weeks after that, I just felt like crap. Like, I just remember, because I felt like crap. I managed to go back to school for a week just before school closed in December, but I looked so pale and so sick. Yeah, and then having to go through the chemo in the summer holidays was hard. And then going back to school the following year was really hard, because I'd lost so much weight from everything my body had gone through. And, God, I was bullied so badly. I was called Skeletor and all this other stuff, because I've always been really tall. I've been the same height since the age of 11, and I'm quite a tall person. Like, I'm 5 foot 10, so it's been that height since the age of 11. But when you lose that amount of weight, I didn't look healthy. I wasn't healthy. But, you know, I managed to drag myself back to school afterwards. I was told that I could potentially have another term off, not a term off school, do my schooling at home to recover. But me being me, I was getting so bored at home. I was like, no, I just want to go to school and things like that. But then having to deal with all the bullying from that, because of what I went through, like a really nasty rumour had gone through the school that apparently I had an abortion. And, oh, my God, that was so hard to deal with. Kids at that age are so nasty.
They're awful, aren't they? I'm just sitting here thinking, you've been through cancer, but no, they've decided that it's something else. Like, what the fuck? What the fuck is wrong with people? Jesus Christ.
It was so intense. And I just remember that year at school, it was so hard. Obviously, by the end of that year, I had recovered quite a bit, and I pretty much felt like myself. But then it's the long-term effects of going through all of that. I think for me, it was like once I got the all clear that I was actually officially remission, and I was like, woohoo, cool. But it was just so intense. So obviously being told also at that age that I most likely would not be able to have children, that surgery and the chemo was going to make me infertile. I didn't actually think anything of that age, because I was like, okay, that's fine, I don't want children anyway. But it's all the other stuff, that the fact that because of it I've always had an irregular cycle. I obviously developed endometriosis, which I now know, because of the surgery that I have, it then doesn't mean you're going to get little bits of that endometrial tissue coming out and then attaching itself to different parts of your body. Obviously, because of the surgery that I had, so much scar tissue and a lot of adhesions in that area. So all of the pain from that, it just had a huge effect on me and like how I felt as a teenager, what I was going through, and this kind of like the hormonal imbalance that it caused, because I was still going through puberty, but then I was doing it with only one ovary, and that poor little ovary was prone to work overtime to try and keep everything as stable as possible. And it was just hard going through my teenage years due to that. And then for some reason, because of all the treatment, for some reason my body actually went into hyperdrive and was actually making too much estrogen. And because of it, I developed a big chest at a very, very young age. And it was like it was after I had the surgery and the chemo, then all of a sudden, holy crap, my boobs just grew in size massively so quickly. Within the space of a month, I went from like an A to B cup, all this time, all of a sudden up to like a double D. And that was at that age when you're 12 as well. Holy crap. And I got bullied.
Bullied
again by the boys, and the boys would be in class and they'd hold like two like soccer balls in front of their chests. And look at me, I'm like Denise, and I'd like feel so, because I was so skinny at that time as well, it looked even more pronounced, and so I just felt so bad. Yeah. I'd always wish I had smaller boobs and stuff like that. And then obviously going through my early 20s, I don't want to have children, and it wasn't until I met my ex-husband and he wanted to have a child, and so we went through fertility specialist. I needed to see whether or not I would actually be able to carry a child, if at all. Then I had my AMH levels tested, and the fertility specialist like looked at me and just said, like, your ovarian reserve is extremely low, which we probably expect when you've only had one ovary for the amount of time that I had by that point. They said, like, your AMH levels are like that of a woman in her early 40s. So I was like, oh, okay. And they said, look, if you want to get pregnant, you need to get pregnant now, because after a certain point, it's probably not going to happen. Yeah, so going through all of that, and even then I was really hesitant in getting pregnant. And something I feel like it's very important to be honest about, because I know for a lot of people, they really want to have a child and they go through all this treatment. And at that time, I was quite, blasé about it. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. And I was also told at that time they can't go through IVF because of all the all the different things you've got to take, they said it could trigger cancer in my left ovary that's left behind. So they said, we just can't take that risk. And I was like, okay. They said, look, we can try some lifestyle modifications, but, you know, just FYI, you're not going to get pregnant. Like, just prepare yourself for that. And I thought, okay, cool. And so, like, you know, with my ex-husband at the time, we tried. We barely tried. I fell pregnant within the first month. I don't know how that happened. Like, honestly, I'm gobsmacked. And I remember looking at the test and then going to my doctors and they're like, holy crap, how the heck did that happen? And then being told afterwards, okay, there's a really high chance that you're going to miscarry because you have so much scar tissue on your uterus. And the things I just spoke about earlier was the sexual assault and the R stuff that I went through as a kid. That causes injury in that part of your body, and that can make it really hard in the future for you to actually fall pregnant and to actually have a healthy pregnancy where your body's not going to miscarry.
Wow.
And so this is the thing that I was being told, was like, body's been through so much trauma, you've got all of the scar tissue, all of this, all of that, it's not going to happen. Like, just, you know, prepare yourself for the fact that you are going to lose the baby. It's something that's going to happen. And so I had a cesarean section, but it's just, I'm quite surprised that I managed to get through all of that and not, But then you have to live with that constant level of fear. And I couldn't really bond with my son because obviously going through the being told I wasn't being able to have children when I was pregnant, not so much blasé attitude, but it was like, I can't get attached to what is growing inside of me. This could end badly. I knew mentally I had to be like that, and that probably sounds very cold, but when you've gone through what I've gone through...
No, but if you're constantly being told...
Yeah, it's okay.
Be prepared for this being the worst case, then you can't. Like, that's intuition telling you to protect yourself.
So because of it, and like people say, oh, but did you enjoy pregnancy? I didn't enjoy it at all. It was really hard on my body physically because of all the surgeries and that. Mm. You know, each time my son would grow, I'd feel the scar tissue and the adhesions stretch.
Wow.
Oh my God, it was so painful sometimes. And there were sometimes where I actually did think I was going through a miscarriage. Just going through all of that, one thing, you know, I was worried was like going through chemo, and especially the chemo that they used to use back in the mid-90s, was like, okay, how did that affect the quality of my eggs? Was my son going to be born with a heap of health issues where it was due to the chemo that I went through? Because I didn't know if the chemo was going to, you know, cause any genetic changes that could, you know, potentially mean that his, you know, his life may have been, you know, a bit harder, you know, for him to have to go through. But it was really hard, and I had to have, like, I did agree to it, but they just wanted to do some genetic testing on him when he was a baby, because they just weren't sure with the chemo what it had actually done. And like, when it came back saying, no, everything's in tip-top shape, I was like, oh, okay, that's good. But I try not to say, oh, that's a good thing. I shouldn't really say it's a good thing, but it's one less thing to have to worry about.
And it's usual, because, like, I mean, you have been through an extraordinary amount of highly traumatic things. Like, I keep thinking about what you're talking about and the fact that you're a child, essentially, when you're going through those things. And it's a lot of the similar stuff that, you know, myself as an adult woman was going through and thinking about, and all of those things. Like, it's huge. It's like this massive stuff that you've been through. And I get that stuff around, like, I haven't been able to have children. Like, we tried naturally and haven't been successful. And then we tried an embryo transfer and it hasn't been successful. Yeah. And it's just really hard to know, like, where my ovaries zapped to pieces by the stuff, or is it my age? It's really complicated. Yeah. And so I totally understand that, given what you went through and given what your pregnancy was like and all of that stuff, that if you could just get this one thing that said, everything's fine.
Yeah. I mean, and I suppose the reason why I try to be careful is because, you know, especially being an autistic person, and people have this mindset of, we can do like genetic screening for autism and that, and I get really iffy around that, because obviously that's going into the field of like eugenics and things like that. And it was, even at that time, it's probably a bit different because it was 2008, 2009 when going through the pregnancy and then having my son and stuff like that. But even then, you know, just being a bit more mindful of, I don't want it to seem like if anything is wrong, if they can see anything genetically, how that change you know, things and stuff like that. I try to be really careful, obviously, with how I say things. Someone like yourself, when you have gone through fertility struggles and you haven't been able to get pregnant, and for some people that can be still quite a sensitive topic when I sometimes speak about my experience. But it's, you know, like, mine's a bit different because of the amount of stuff that I've been through mentally. I just could not get attached or get excited or do any of that, because I just knew that there was such a high chance of things going wrong. What I went through at that age and everything that I went through has such had a profound impact on me in later years, and just the health impact that it's had. Starting menopause in my early 30s was a bit of a shock to the system. I knew that it was happening. I was told it was going to happen because, depending on what age you have ovaries removed, if you know, have one removed at the age that I did, then you do go into early menopause. However, you know, for some people, if they have it removed in their 20s or their 30s, it's less likely to happen. You've had that extra time for your body to, you know, have two ovaries to make all the good stuff, whereas you've got one that's just, like, getting so tired and worn out. And it's just, hard going through all of that. And the other thing I had to deal with on top of all of that, going through all those years, again, the other reason why I was told I probably wouldn't get pregnant is because I had PCOS, which my left ovary was just covered. It's just the whole thing, so painful. And going through all of that, and that only developed after I had been through the chemotherapy as well. Again, it caused all these different hormonal imbalances as well. And like the health effects from having PCOS as well was quite intense. And then it's only been very recently that I've been told that I no longer have it. But it's just going through all of that, I didn't really think of it as like a bad thing. Like, it's not weird, but it's just what it is. Like, my body is the way that it is for these reasons. And for me, I try not to dwell on the negative aspects too much, because I'm really bad at, I can overanalyze and dwell on things for too long. And once you've gone through chemo and all of that, is that you are going to have to deal with these side effects that kind of like last for the rest of your life. And the younger that you have it, the longer that you have it for as well. So sometimes that can be quite hard mentally to deal with the fact that obviously your birth certificate may say, you know, that you're only 25, but you've just gone through all this treatment and your body's probably aged 10 to 15 years plus on top of that because of what it's had to go through and stuff like that. And so you're having to deal with the fact that you might be 25, but you actually feel like you're 20 years older inside of your body because just things just don't move as well. And it's been...
It's so true. It's really interesting you say that, because I had an inkling because of the way my body has felt post-treatment. But I was talking to a breast cancer surgeon who's actually had breast cancer herself twice. Yeah, we were just talking about post-treatment. She said, your chemo especially ages you 10 years. And it's just like this light bulb went off in my head and went, oh, my God, that's one of the reasons why things just feel a little bit bloody harder. But I feel like what you've really highlighted is that, A, our bodies are so complex and we are all very different. Yeah. And some of us have more complex health histories than other people do, and for whatever reasons. Yeah. And that when it comes to cancer and our recovery and all of those things, that it's, it is quite individual. Yeah. It is complex. And we need to go easy on ourselves. Yeah. I mean, you've been grappling with this since you were 11, and that keeps hitting me because I think one of the things of being a cancer survivor, even though I hate that word, is that that is what we're living with every day. We're living with the little thing hanging over our head saying, am I going to come back? And then if it does, how do I deal with it? And that's what our reality is. The will I have kids? Maybe not. Am I going to go into menopause really early? Am I going to develop something else? You have been through an extraordinary amount of medical things. How do you keep on top of that? And how have you been able to navigate the health system on top of it not being neurodivergent friendly?
I do keep records. I went to law school for a very long time. In law school, you learn to keep evidence. But for me, it's more I have everything online in very secure folders. I have backups of backups and paper copies of things. I think also because of the sort of memory that I do have, I just remember things very clearly. I remember dates and when things happen, and so it's quite easy for me to relay that information without being overwhelmed that I'm forgetting something, especially in terms of your health records and information. I just make sure that I have things tucked away in certain places so I can go back to it if I need to. For me, because of the sort of brain that I have, I am quite interested in what's actually happening in my body, and so I don't find it overwhelming. However, for some reason, when it does come to, let's say, stuff to do with my mental health, especially if, you know, I haven't had an episode of depression, or 2016 was my last time I had, you know, I had depression, but usually when I'm in that state, I get quite overwhelmed with dealing with like my mental health stuff. So yes. With that, I do have a document that I have written up, and I just give it to whoever doctor is seeing me, so I don't actually have to say anything. They can just read it, and it has all the information that they need. But as I think, again, you can, depending on what type of neurodivergence that you have and how you handle certain types of information and what sort of state your brain is in at that time, sometimes it can get quite overwhelming. But when it comes to all of the cancer stuff that I've gone through and I still, you know, having to deal with to this day, that's, for me, isn't actually hard. I just remember things so well. But yeah, again, with all my cancer stuff, I have another document that's already written up, so I can give it to a doctor who's new and doesn't know me or probably hasn't actually read my file, because I do get quite annoyed when I'm having to repeat myself over and over again. I'm just like,
oh yeah, me like, too.
Can you just please just a quick 5-minute read of my file and you'll be up to date with everything. So yeah, that for me is, that's how I deal with all that information. It's quite overwhelming, but yeah, it just depends on the type of information I'm dealing with and what sort of health issue that I'm dealing with as well. I can get a bit panicky sometimes, especially when I feel a little niggle. You know, I'm not a hypochondriac, but I do like to get things done, like checked as soon as that they can. And so that can be quite hard for me sometimes, where, especially when it's like same pain or feeling that I had when I had the cancer, and I start freaking out, like, oh yeah, shit, maybe it's back, and I can get quite panicky over that until I've had a checkup done and the scans done. They're like, okay, you're fine. And then sense of relief, and they're like, okay, that's cool. So just, it is quite overwhelming, just especially with all the health issues that I have. It's just a lot, and every single one of them is connected to each other in some way. Like, you have one thing and then it increases your chances of developing the other thing, and you end up developing that other thing and something else happens. And people tend to think, oh, but I thought you'd be immobile or not able to move in it. But they don't quite see disability as, you know, people still view disability as like a really physical thing rather than it can be invisible. With what we deal with in terms of post-cancer treatment and the permanent effects that it actually has on your body. And the other thing that kind of adds on top of that is that when you're dealing with all this health stuff and all this health information, all these doctors, is that, especially when you've gone through cancer treatment, is that you don't gain that last 5 to 10% of your health back again if you do go into remission. No. It's gone forever. And 25 years later, I can never, ever get that 5% back. I've tried really hard, and it's gone. All the other, some of the other health stuff that I've had, that's taken away even more of my health that I can't get back. Yeah, it just makes it even more challenging. And, you know, sometimes I do feel a level of resentment every now and then because of what I went through when I was like 11/12. It's like, holy crap, if I didn't have this cancer and if I didn't go through this treatment and have all the surgery and all this sort of thing, I wouldn't be feeling the way that I am right now. So a bit resentment. It's not as much as it used to be when I was younger, because I just go, whatever it is. But especially when my health is really bad, like when I'm really run down and I can't physically get out of bed because I'm in so much pain, I would just lie there and cry because I just feel like, oh, what was me? And things like that. And then it's like the next day I wake, I feel better, and then I don't feel that way anymore. But just having those little reminders, yeah, that's a lot. And then you having to then convey that information to health professionals. And I do get a bit frustrated sometimes, especially when I've spent time putting information together and I've forwarded it to them in advance. And they haven't read it.
And they don't read it.
I'm like, I'm trying to make your job easier. So you don't have to read through 200 pages of my notes. It's all in like a 1 to 2 page, concise, succinct, compacted, like, you know, version of things. So
yeah. It is a lot. It's huge. And as you've been talking, because I think I put a lot of pressure on myself to do things and being self-sufficient and stuff. And as I've been listening to you, I've been thinking, there just is, and it's really difficult to explain to people who perhaps aren't neurodivergent or don't have a loved one what those barriers are. Because I keep thinking, I take the blood test example. Okay, I've had things I've needed to do to, I still haven't had it, still getting the courage. It's like I rang the lab test to ask them, I'm really scared of blood tests and I've had medical trauma after having cancer. What's the best thing I can do? And they're like, well, ask for a senior, you know, blood taker. I know there's a fence in there for it. But she couldn't tell me when the quietest time was, which was tricky. But so what I'm trying to do is learn to advocate for myself in that way. Because the last time I went there, I had a panic attack and I started crying because it was in the middle of like fertility stuff. And so try to navigate past all of that and be an adult and be like, yep, come on, we'll go get that blood test. But also, like, you made such a good point of there will be some days where it's like, nah, today's not that day. It's just not, this is not the time. And I know this is the week before my period, for instance, it's not that time. Yeah. Listening to you talk about it makes me realize how many things we are often juggling as a neurodivergent adult, especially when you've had a complex health history. It's huge. Yeah.
I have a certain level of privilege. I've been dealing with the public health system for so long. I know the ins and outs. I know to get the results or action that I need like right there and then.
Yes.
And because of it, a lot of experiences for some people, it's been very different for me. Just because I know how to advocate for myself. You know, not every single autistic ADHD person has either the courage or the means or ability to be able to do that, whereas I do. Like, I do stick up for myself. And I do put my foot down when I feel like I'm not being treated fairly by people, or I've been, they're trying to treat me as if I'm like a dumb, stupid person. I'm like, I'm not stupid whatsoever. The complete opposite, actually. But the patronising tone of some medical professionals can really annoy me sometimes. It's interesting as a cis woman that if you are confident in yourself and you stand up for yourself and you are firm, people say, oh, bit chi or, you know, whatever it is. You know, you're very difficult to
have. Yeah, absolutely.
But, like, but if a man does it, he's confident and he knows what he wants and blah, blah, all that sort of thing. It's a bit different now, but especially medical professionals, it's 15, 20 years ago, it was a very different experience that as a woman that you are treated differently and you're not told everything that you should be told. Yeah, I've just learned to build up like this armour. Like, I always go into every single point, yes, I know what I'm wanting. I really don't let that guard down because I have to be like that to get the results that I want.
Yeah.
And it's been really good in terms of whenever I have to go and get checked up again because I feel a niggle or some other symptom, because I do go and say, hey, this needs to be done. When is it going to be done? I try to, sometimes doctors have been like, oh, you know, maybe a couple of, what, I was like, no, I need to know time frames. When should I expect to see, when will this be done? Can you please notify me when this will be done? That sort of thing. And so there's a huge amount of privilege in having and being able to do that. And a lot of neurodivergent people just aren't able to do that. But because of it, I do try to advocate a bit more for neurodivergent people. I might be doing something, but I'll mention to the doctor, hey, FYI, most autistic people will not be able to handle it this way. Maybe if you phrase it in a certain way, it will be better received and that sort of thing. And so a lot of them seem to be quite happy because they don't really know how to deal with autistic people. That actually quite funny when you do come across a doctor who is autistic or ADHD. Like, you can, I know, like, that thing just pings up, like, you're like me. And because of it, they relay information to me in a way that I actually understand. And I'm sort of, thank you so much. I really, you know, thank you for, you know, telling me it in that way. And they go back to me a lot of the time. They're like, oh, yeah, but a lot of my patients don't like my style. Like, they say I'm too direct and blunt and upfront and stuff like that. And I just have to giggle inside, like, yes, I know, because that's, you know, it's an autistic.
So am I.
Yeah, so am I. But yeah, just like whenever I recognise, you know, one of our people, I'm like, you're going to understand me. Yes. I'm not going to have to go, it's not going to be a fight. When I do come across a doctor that is not neurodivergent, that can be a bit of an uphill battle. And I really have to be quite firm. You know, I'm not mean, but it's like, this is what is happening. I know this is the test that you have to do. When are we going to do it? I need a time frame, blah, 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 blah. And I think sometimes they just need somebody who just wants to have things done in a particular way. And also, just being an autistic person that I am, I do like things done in a particular way. And I do get quite upset when, you know, let's say an appointment isn't done in a certain way, when I know a certain check should be done and it hasn't been done. And I, you know, I'll be sitting up, okay, are you going to do this particular check? And they didn't actually think about it or whatever it is, or they didn't think it was necessary. But I'm like, well, no, actually it needs to be done for these reasons. And it's a huge amount of privilege and just being able to, being the sort of person that I am. But if I can, just advocate for us a bit more with those health professionals and say, hey, you might come across someone else like me. This is probably the best way to do it. And also, you know, you do get a lot of things. Oh, you don't seem like you're autistic. I have to laugh. I'm like, oh. It's like, oh, so you're basing it off what you've seen in The Rain Man, are you? Or Big Bang Theory?
Yeah, I was just thinking, because I'm not Rain Man.
You know, you mentioned your test, like, oh, yeah, I watch Big Bang Theory. I'm like, oh, God, that is, like, the worst portrayal of autistic people. Like, I just know. Yes.
It's so funny, isn't it? Because I also think with ADHD, the way I've experienced it, one of the biggest things has been around emotional regulation and how intensely I feel things.
I have a theory that autism and ADHD is actually part of the same spectrum. There's so much overlap, and
I think there is.
Yes. Diagnosed with ADHD first, and then it may be a short time while later, or even 1 to 2 years later, and they're like, oh, I'm also autistic as well. Or you're diagnosed with autism first, and then sometime later, it's, oh, yeah, I'm also ADHD. And so I look at the huge overlap. There's obviously some things that we think of being like as typically autistic, you know, apparently no eye contact in my life because I've got an autistic son and he makes plenty of eye contact. Yeah. that sort of thing. I am very stereotypical in that way just because I find it very intense to actually look people in the eyes.
I just do it. I'm like, too intense.
Something obviously I've had to recently deal with was having to, a couple of years ago, feel a lump in my breast and completely and utterly freak out and think, oh, shit, this is it. It's back, you know, cancer's back again. And it was really hard because I felt the lump when, obviously, 2020, we had that other little mini lockdown in Auckland in August of that year. And that's when I felt my lump and I was like, oh, no. And obviously with the previous lockdown, and so because of it, there was a big, huge backlog with people being able to get mammograms done and things like that. And I remember calling up my doctor and saying what's happened, and we were locked down at that time, and she said, look, I'll try as hard as I can to get you seen as quickly as possible. But she said, look, because of the lockdowns and stuff, they're really quite behind in the doing. And yeah, and obviously at that time I didn't quite have the full level of health insurance that I now have. and so having to go through the public system at that time, so I had to wait. And it was like a 6-week wait, and I just remember like, oh God, this is terrible. Like I worked myself up so much, like I was absolutely petrified that I was going to go in and they were going to say, yep, this is what it is. And you know, I had to mentally prepare myself for the fact, like, okay, I'm going to have surgery and go through chemo, and I know what genetic mutation that I have, so I know what type of breast cancer I'm most likely going to have, and you know, all this, you know, throw all this inside my head. And then like, obviously then going in, I had my mammogram and had the ultrasound done, and then had the biopsies taken as well. And then the waiting time after they take the biopsies, that is excruciating. Like, it, I was like, oh, crap.
It's hideous. It's absolutely hideous waiting for that. Yeah.
And they took a biopsy, and, you know, and then obviously I was told that it was like a fibroid adenoma, but I had, like, there was high levels of endothelial hyperplasia in the sample that they took. And, like, some of the cells just weren't quite normal looking enough, but not quite in that thing of saying, yep, it's definitely cancer. Okay, it's just now just a waiting game of we just do frequent scans, do biopsies if we need to, and see whether or not it does progress any further. And it's hard. And I'm so appreciative of the fact that my body has managed to still keep itself together. And despite what I deal with, I am, you know, I am actually considered a really healthy person, which I laugh at whenever I get all my, you know, my yearly medical checkup done. Most days my body, you know, feel, you know, has all these different aches and pains, and these days where I just have full on nausea for, I can have it for 2 to 3 days and I don't know what's caused it. I just feel really sick. And yeah, it's just like little reminders that, yeah, my body's been through a lot, but I really do appreciate the fact that I've managed to survive for this long. I try not to think I'm going to die young. I try to think of the fact like, oh, if anything, there could be like everyone else in my family that has had cancer and managed to live until the early to late 90s. So, like, maybe I'll be like them. Yeah. It just has a huge impact on your life forever and the decisions that you make and just how you approach things, and how it also just made me a lot more gentle with myself about certain things as well. I've had the time to no longer hate myself and hate what my body had done and be like, actually, I don't hate it. I actually, God, you know, it's done a brilliant job of getting me through all of this. And just being able to connect with other people that have survived cancer, I really appreciate the fact that we're able to tell our stories and what we've been through, and we're able to find that common ground between us of what we've been through, because we talk about something and it's, oh yeah, I went through that. It makes you feel better about yourself that you weren't just the only person that felt that way or went through all of that. Yeah, and especially like with ovarian cancer, if I can tell my story to younger people that are going through it, I think that seems to help them a lot. Just them knowing that somebody who was really young managed to survive it. It can sometimes, I do get really upset though, especially when it's somebody who's younger and they've actually got stage 2 or stage 3 ovarian cancer, and I know that's just, you're not really going to come back from that. And so it's really hard talking to someone who is really young, like I recently spoke to someone who was in the early 20s and she knew it was terminal, but she just wanted to talk to somebody who was a survivor. And I just, you know, spoke to her about various things and I let her message me all the time and stuff like that, and you know, especially when she was in hospital, and sometimes I wouldn't hear from her for a couple of days and she'd be like, oh, so sorry, oh, you know, I felt so sick and I was just doing this. And I was like, no, that's totally fine, like I completely understand. But then it really hits me emotionally that I then get told, yeah, especially with her, that she had passed away. And I was like, oh, crap. I've been talking to her for all this time and trying really hard to cheer her on. And then, okay, this is the last proper conversation that I had with her. It was like she was on the last line of treatment. This was it. There was nothing else that they could do to help her. And, God, that was so hard, just then getting a message from her parents saying what had happened. And I just felt, God, intense sadness. But I think just for her, just knowing that she could talk to someone that had been through it at such a young age and then me being older, I think it just helped her just to get through her last days, because it was quite intense and painful for her. And I think just if it just eased that pain for her just a little bit, like it, you know, it makes me feel better inside. But yeah, I just felt so bad afterwards. I remember crying and being like, yeah, it was just, it was hard.
It is hideous. I totally get that. Because I dip in and out of some of Facebook groups and stuff, and I have people that I sort of message with and things, but I think there is part of me that just keeps a little bit emotionally distant from it. Because one of the things about being a cancer survivor, especially when you're younger, is that people will die. Yeah. It just is. I've had a woman who took part in I did a campaign last year for Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and people submitted their stories, and she passed away earlier this year. And I felt really weird because I've never met this person, but we'd emailed and messaged and over a short period of time. And so there was part of me that was like, oh, I don't have the right to cry about this. But I think part of it is our own sadness, because we know what that person, we know what that was like.
Yeah, I like you. I do keep myself emotionally distant, but it was just this particular person in one of the groups. And she was just so young. The majority of the people, especially ovarian cancer groups, are a lot older, and so it can be really hard for them to relate to someone who like barely left their teen years, if at all, and they're scared. And and a lot of the older people, like, they're trying to say, oh, you know, sorry that you're going through it and stuff like that. And I quickly mentioned them, but I was like, oh, yeah, I'm through at this age. And I said, more than happy for you to privately message me and we can talk about things a bit more.
I'm in the weird sort of space where part of me likes connecting in with people and then part of me, so we all keep bloody dying. Yeah. It is a hard thing to grapple with and carry. And I feel like that's something that I am quite vocal about, is that no, I'm not bloody over it. Like, I have a daily reminder of my disease. And also there is so much rhetoric out there about survival rates and this, that and the other. And it's I'm just trying to live as if things are going to be all right. So I just, I feel like you've highlighted so many of the things that we all just deal with. And you just do. You just have to deal with it once you've had that cancer.
Yeah, and it's just like kind of the cherry on top is like, you know, being neurodivergent, and that just, you know, just makes me so bit harder. Just, it's just like, just a little bit further. And yeah, it's such an intense experience. But that I now know, because of what I've been through and stuff like that, I do know that if it does return, I've prepared myself. Like, mentally, I know what's going to happen, what I'll need to go through, and all of that. And again, that's for me, that's like another level of privilege that I have, because it's not going to be like out of the blue and shock me and do all that. I'll be like, okay, cool, that's sweet, I'm fine with that. I might cry a little bit, but I'm a lot more mentally prepared for that and things like that. And the other sad thing is, like, when you have a kid and you're in remission, and sometimes when I do talk about the stuff, it's really hard that sometimes my son does have to be prepared for the fact that things may come back, and this is what may happen. And it was something that I was told to do by a couple of specialists, especially as a single parent and the other parent is not in the same country, is that you have to be hyper-organised and prepared if the cancer does come back. Like, what have I got in place legally to make sure that he's going to be looked after and protected, and all of that, and like having those hard conversations with people that are close to you and saying, hey, are you okay with being listed as a guardian in my will if this happens and stuff like that. And so, some of my friends are like, I don't talk about it. It's like, well, I have to because I've got a kid and I'm a single parent and the other parent isn't around. And
you have to provide for him.
Now, making sure I've got life insurance and all that sort of thing. And if I get really, really sick, who do I feel comfortable with having power of attorney over certain parts of my affairs if I get too sick and things like that? Do I trust this person enough to do this and all of that other thing? And but again, I'm like that because of what I've been through. I have to be prepared. And some people just think it's over the top, but it's no, because I know, you know, things can just turn to shit like really quickly and you have to be prepared to a certain level to just try and minimise, try and mitigate some of the impact that it can have on your life. But yeah, sometimes I just forget that I've had cancer. I don't know what, you know, I just have a really good day and I just my mind just completely forgets about it. And then a couple of days later, I get hit with, like, oh, yes, I did actually have cancer in the past because I feel like this. So, you know, chemo, you know, you still have chemo brain 25 years later. You still have it, like, it's still there.
Yeah. Denise, it's been so cool to talk to you again. I feel like every time I talk to you, I just get a little bit more little gems and things. And I think it's just, it is good to talk and remember stuff. As a part of it is that how fucking spectacular we are and amazing of what we've been through, but yet we still prevail. You know, like, as cheesy as that sounds, but yet we still get up every bloody morning and we do what we need to do. And I think it's a really good reminder, even if you're not neurodivergent and have that extra complexity, just that reminder that, hey, like, you've been through a life-altering experience. Give yourself a fucking break.
No, our bodies have been through so much. We've, again, like, you know, hate using the term survivor as well, but somehow our bodies have still here, still alive, and it's, I'm really grateful. And, you know, every now and then, obviously, I've got physical reminders on my abdomen with all the surgeries that I've had, different surgeries I've had over the years, and I look down and I can see, you know, I still have that visual reminder of what I went through at that age.
Thanks so much for listening. The C Word is every Sunday at 11:55 a.m. on Auckland's 104.6 Planet FM and anytime at www.planetaudio.org.nz/C Word.
Cause I always had a passion for flashing. Before I had it, I closed my eyes and imagined.